The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue reading from the May 2021 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and we'll finish up the article that we started on our last program titled The End of the Trail by Tony Ferratitet. And this is about his adventures across Oregon. The subtitle of this article says, A vintage guidebook inspires a quirky trip through Oregon, from a wilderness lodge to a Gilded Age saloon to a town hidden underground. So to pick back up with the article, something about this remote corner of Oregon keeps hopeful memories alive. This is quite an achievement given the state's grim racial history, starting with its very inception. The first white settlers declared that they were building a non-slave state, but exclusion laws also banned African Americans from living there. One law, passed in 1844, threatened any freed slave with a lashing every 6 months until he or she left. Although this savage legal provision was never enforced, when Oregon joined the Union in 1859, the state constitution prohibited black people from moving there. For years, Oregon's Jim Crow laws were the most severe outside the South, with the few black residents denied the right to vote, own real estate, or enter legal contracts. Chinese gold miners were also harassed mercilessly in the late 19th century and occasionally massacred. Life grew so bad in the town of Pendleton, for example, the Asian community moved into underground chambers and tunnels, leaving a unique ghost town that can be visited to this day. But by the 1920s, African Americans were the main targets. The Ku Klux Klan was resurgent around Oregon, and some sundown towns set up billboards warning, Do not let the sun catch you. In Portland, many businesses hung signs, even in the Eisenhower era, We cater to white trade only. But today, attention is being given to an extraordinary exception to the grim narrative. The logging camp of Maxville, a lonely settlement 39 miles from Joseph in the Wallowa Mountains, resisted Oregon's racist current. And from 1923 until the late 1930s, flourished by becoming more integrated. The story is now being retold by one of the black logger's daughters, Gwendolyn Trice, who formed a nonprofit in 2008 and set up a small museum in Joseph called the Maxville Heritage Interpretive Center in 2012, and succeeded in 2020 to reclaim the original campsite to set up her own version of the Nez Perce homeland. I discovered the unlikely story when I found the small museum one afternoon. Wearing a weathered straw cowboy hat and a bright floral vintage skirt, Trice welcomed me at the door, saying, Come on in. Hanging in pride of place on the wall, inside was a grainy sepia photograph from the 1920s, which showed a team of African-American loggers dressed in overalls with enormous saws over their shoulders, posing alongside white workers in a mountain forest. Another picture showed a half a dozen black and white children sitting together with their teacher in a field of cabins. Both were scenes that would have seemed like science fiction elsewhere in the state. The logging camp, Trice explained, sprang up seemingly overnight in 1923, when a railroad was carved into the wilderness and houses were shipped in on boxcars. Defying the exclusion laws, which were on Oregon's books until 1927, the Bowman Hicks Lumber Company hired some 60 skilled black loggers from the South, including her father, 19-year-old Lafayette Lucky Trice of Arkansas. Maxville was officially a segregated township with two housing districts, two baseball teams, and two schools. With the racial division quickly eroded, it was a big fail, Trice said with a laugh. People were connected in many different ways. They worked alongside one another. They had to rely on one another. The family saw each other every day. People became friends. I'm a descendant of that failure. The anomaly drew the attention of the local chapter of the Klan. A posse came to Maxville to try to get rid of the black loggers, but the white superintendent de-hooded the leader. He said, "Get out. You are not welcome here. We know who you are." Barriers were also broken down by Maxville's extreme isolation, especially during the bitter winters. You live close to nature here. It's not man pitted against man. It's like in war. You have to work together. The Great Depression ended this unique social experiment, and in 1933, most of Maxville's houses were put back on boxcars and shipped out. Soon the camp had all but vanished. But Lucky Try stayed on in the nearby town of LeGrand, where Gwendolyn grew up as the second youngest of his six children. She was almost always the only black student in her school year, but otherwise had a child typical of rural Oregon of that time, she says, listening to Johnny Cash and Glen Campbell, riding horses and fishing with her father. In 1977, she moved to Seattle, where she worked for Boeing and as an actor, screenwriter, and video producer. Her father died in 1985 without ever talking about his early life in Maxville. Trice began learning about her father being a logger in 2003 and started the process of moving back in 2005, where she began piecing it together by interviewing the camp's elderly white residents, many of whom had been children in Maxville and still lived nearby. She brought her research to Oregon Public Broadcasting, which featured her efforts in a documentary and allowed her to reach a wider audience. In 2015, the nonprofit foundation was given the camp's lone surviving structure, the company headquarters, by the new land orders. A November 2020 grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust, Justice Oregon for Black Lives, an initiative to invest in long-term strategic change in the state, along with the Maxville Heritage Interpretive Center's ongoing fundraising efforts, should allow for the purchase of 240 acres of Maxville and surrounds by the end of the year. "Let's take a gander," Trice suggested. Soon we were driving north of Joseph onto an unpaved service road, while logging trucks roared past and a startled elk looked on. The site itself is now overgrown and reforested, but she conjured its heyday in the 1920s as a thriving camp of 400 people, and walked its long-vanished streets using a map reconstructed from the memory of the elders. While much was left to the imagination, not everything had disappeared. We stepped over an old water pump, the remains of the machinery workshop, and the four-acre town dump. A few miles away on private land stands the last of Maxville's wooden railroad trestle bridges, still spanning a gully. The sun was setting as we stood by the pond that is part of the property, watching blue herons pick their way across a carpet of white lilies. If all goes well, the log lodge that served as the original Maxville Company HQ, which was documented, then taken apart and put in storage, will begin to be reconstructed on site by the 100th anniversary of Maxville in 2023, with funds from Oregon's Cultural Advocacy Coalition. The grounds will also serve as a field school for archaeology and education hub and tour site. The regeneration of the lakeside and river areas will proceed in partnership with Nez Perce tribes. As we drove back to Joseph, Trice offered a personal perspective on the WPA guidebook to Oregon. She said it should be read alongside the famous Negro Motorist Green Book, the guide written for African Americans. The reality is that in 1940, black travelers in Oregon would not even have been served at most gas stations or restaurants, and usually had to sleep in their cars. Even in the early 1960s, black travelers stopped at her father's home in LeGrand. "I remember as a little girl, there would be a knock on the door in the middle of the night," Trice said. Her father would go talk to black people who were driving through and tell them where they could stay with a family or friendly place to buy food and gas. By then, the racial balance in Oregon had already started to shift. With the tiny African-American population swelled by shipbuilders who went to Portland during World War II and remained. The 1964 Civil Rights Act changed the legal landscape, Trice said, and the BLM movement provides the latest nudge. When I arrived here 20 years ago, nobody was interested in the Maxville story. People acted afraid of the color of my skin. But now we've got a museum in the middle of Joseph, and we're loved. In summer, we get hundreds of visitors every month. She laughed. America is changing, doggone it. For the week, I had been traveling around Wallowa Lake. Wildfire smoke ensured that its fabled mountain scenery was barely visible. But back in Portland, the winds changed and blue skies opened. For the reminder of the state's grandeur, Lisa Lipton, the director of Opera Theater Oregon, offered to take me to one of the city's most theatrical natural settings, near downtown along the Columbia River Highway. The Vista House, an Art Nouveau structure perched on a promontory once known as Thor's Heights, was built in 1950 as a pit stop for the first American road trippers to enjoy views of the river framed by cliffs and peaks. It's like an opera set, only outdoors, Lipton said, summing up much of Oregon's spectacular landscape. I'm thinking Wagner, maybe Tristan and Isolde. The highway engineer, Samuel Lancaster, declared in 1950 that he had designed Vista House as an observatory where mortals could pause, in the silent communion with the infinite, in short, a temple to nature. He had also dedicated it to the pioneers of the Oregon Trail and the hardships they had endured. Today it's clear that other cultures also undertook painful journeys. The future looks promising. As more historical stories come to light, 21st century travelers will find it only natural to explore the rich and complex human past that is entwined with Oregon's lavish scenic beauty. Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section, Travel, titled Roger Gets the Last Word by Claudia Kalb. Long before compiling his famed thesaurus, he had to escape Napoleon's dragnet. In January 1802, Peter Marc Roger was an ambivalent young medical student graduate with no clear path. He lacked the professional connections that were crucial to a fledgling English physician, and was eager for a reprieve from a life largely orchestrated by his widowed mother, Catherine, and his uncle and surrogate father, Samuel Romilly, who together had steered him to study medicine. Roger had spent the previous year, 4 years since his graduation, taking additional courses and working odd jobs, even volunteering in the spring of 1799 as a test subject at the Pneumatic Institution in Clifton, England, for a trial of the sedative nitrous oxide, also known as laughing gas. With no immediate professional path, he felt unsettled and despondent. Romilly suggested a change of scenery. Accordingly, he introduced his nephew to John Phillips, a wealthy cotton mill owner in Manchester, with the plan that Roger would chaperone Phillips's teenage sons, Burton and Nathaniel, who are about to embark on a year-long trip to the continent to study French and prepare for a career in business. Roger had caught a bid break, or so he thought. The timing, it turns out, could not have been worse. And so began a telling adventure in the early life of a man known worldwide for his lexicography and his Thesaurus of English Words and Phrases, one of the most influential reference books in the English language. The French Revolutionary Wars, during which France declared war on Great Britain in 1793, had been halted by an armistice in the fall of 1801 under the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte. With a peace treaty set to be ratified in the northern French town of Amiens that following March, British travelers were jamming the boats that plied the English Channel, eager to set foot in Paris for the first time in almost a decade. Roger and his two charges left London in February 1802, a few weeks after Roger's 23rd birthday. Their journey followed many aspects of the traditional Grand Tour, a rite of passage for young British aristocrats. Armed with letters of introduction, along with a salary of £400 for Roger, plus money for expenses, the travelers boarded a packet boat, a mid-sized vessel carrying mail, freight, and passengers, and crossed from Dover to Calais. There, Roger hired a three-horse carriage, which transported them through the northern French countryside to Paris. The trio's first 3 months in Paris were relatively uneventful. Roger enlisted a French tutor for the boys and took them on daily outings to the Museum of Natural History to study science. They visited the Louvre and Notre Dame Cathedral, enjoying afternoon strolls along the Bois de Boulogne, and attended the theater regularly. The actors, Nathaniel noted, were superior to any we have in London. Not all their verdicts were positive. I begin to like the cooking better, yet I shall never take to the fricandeau, which is a terrible dish, composed of beef, spinach oil, and bacon, Nathaniel wrote to his parents. Roger, for his part, bemoaned the country's apparent lack of hygiene. The pavement stones were greasy and slippery, he wrote, and the men in general wear cocked hats and are very dirty in their persons. They wear large earrings and often allow the beard to descend from the ears under the chin. For centuries, travel to France had provided wealthy Brits with the chance to pronounce judgments on their geopolitical rivals, escape from the damp fog of England, and revel in the magnetic charms of Paris. France, in 1802, offered something new, the prospect of seeing Napoleon, of whom everybody wanted to catch a glimpse, notes Jeremy Popkin, a historian at the University of Kentucky. Just weeks into their stay, Roger and the boys had their first chance to see the great man at the Tuileries Palace in early March. He is thin and of low stature. His countenance, though meager and sallow, is extremely animated. His eyes black and piercing, his hair black and cropped, his dress remarkably plain, Burton wrote. They saw him again on Easter Sunday, in a regal procession celebrating his resuscitation of the Catholic Church, which had been a target of anti-religious policies during the Revolution. Bonaparte bowed in response to the applause of the populace. His carriage was drawn by 8 superbly decorated horses, Nathaniel reported in April. The great bell of Notre Dame, which had been silent 10 years, was rung, along with a 60-gun salute. The toll of the revolution became most evident when the trio departed Paris for Geneva in May. En route, they surveyed the dilapidated 12th-century palace of Fontainebleau. It might formerly have been well worth seeing, but it has suffered greatly from the fury of the mob, and now stripped of its ancient honors, it stands a monument of the devastation wrought by the revolutionary storms, Roger wrote. Geneva, by contrast, greeted Roger and the boys with glorious vistas of the Alps and their first taste of frog pâté. But here, almost a year into their blissful tour, they found themselves trapped amid a flare-up of hostilities between Britain and France. An increasingly imperious Bonaparte expanded his territorial reach into northern Italy, northwest Germany, Holland, and Switzerland, thereby impinging on Britain's foreign trade. King George III lamented the French ruler's restless disposition, and on May 18th, a little more than 1 year after the armistice, Britain declared war on France. In retribution, Bonaparte issued a decree that all British citizens in French territory over the age of 18 be held as prisoners of war, including those living in Geneva, an independent city-state that Napoleon had annexed. Roger was stunned. The measure was so unprecedented and so atrocious as to appear destitute of all foundation, he wrote. But Geneva's commandant, a man named Dupuc, made it clear that English adults were under strict orders to surrender and be transported to Verdun, a small city in northeast France, where they would be required to find lodgings of their own or else be put up in barracks. Although British captives were not in literal prisons, they even attended the theater and horse races. They were denied many basic freedoms. The Phillips boys were too young to be subject to Napoleon's edict, but Roger was leery of sending them off alone. His first instinct was for the three of them to flee. But after taking a carriage to the outskirts of the city, they discovered the gendarmes had been placed at every exit route to stop escapees. Retreating to their lodgings, Roger petitioned officials in Paris for exemptions as a medical doctor and tutor of 2 teenage boys. These entreaties failed. Now deeply panicked about the safety of his charges, Roger sent the boys over the border to the Swiss Confederacy, first to one of John Phillips's business associates in Lausanne, and then farther north to Neuchâtel to await his arrival. In mid-July, Roger resorted to a final desperate course of action, changing his citizenship. His father, Jean, was a Genevese citizen who had grown up in the city before moving to London as a young adult and had died of tuberculosis in 1783. On July 21, Dupuc, the commandant, growing impatient with Roger's efforts to elude captivity, demanded that Roger present Genevese papers by 7 a.m. the next day. Otherwise, Roger would join his fellow countrymen who were being readied for Verdun. Somehow, Roger managed to track down Jean Roger's baptismal certificate, as well as a regional official who would authenticate their father-son relationship. The official was playing boules at a club when Roger found him and did not want to be disturbed, but a financial incentive changed his mind. At length, by tickling the palm of his hand, he promised to be ready for me by 6 the next morning. On the 26th of July, with Genevieve's citizenship documents in hand, Roger hastened to Neuchâtel and reunited with the boys. But their ordeal was hardly over. The passport Roger had obtained in Geneva was invalid for further travel, and he needed new paperwork to journey north. Unable to obtain the paperwork quickly, he and the boys simply made a run for it. Dressed in shabby clothing so as not to look like tourists they were, they traveled through obscure villages, avoided speaking English, and after bribing a French guard on the border town of Brugge with a bottle of wine, crossed the Rhine River by ferry to unoccupied German soil. It is impossible to describe the rapture we felt in treading on friendly ground, Roger wrote. It was like awaking from a horrid dream or recovering from a nightmare. Back in England, Roger launched his career as a physician and inventor in 1804 at the age of 25, going on to lecture and publish extensively. In 1814, the year Bonaparte abdicated as emperor, Roger published a paper about a logarithmic slide rule he had invented, earning him election as a fellow to the Royal Society of London at the age of 36. His most momentous work was an exhaustive surveillance of physiology in vegetable and animal kingdoms, which composed one of the celebrated 8 Bridgewater treatises, a series of books published in the 1830s that considered science in the context of theology. In 1849, after retiring from medicine and science, the 70-year-old turned to words, a passion that harkened back to his childhood, when he had filled a notebook with English translations of Latin vocabulary and then classified them into subject areas. Roger's early passion never dissipated. In his mid-20s, during off hours, the young doctor compiled a list of some 15,000 words, a little collection he later called it, that, although scanty and imperfect, had helped him in his writing over the years. Now a man of leisure, Roger unearthed his earliest compilation. One of Roger's greatest gifts, his biographer D.L. Emblin writes, was a determination to bring about order in that which lacked it. Over the next 3 years in his Bloomsbury home, just steps from leafy Russell Square, Roger assembled his words into 6 overarching categories, including matter, intellect, and volition. Roger's work echoed the organizational principles of Carl Linnaeus, the pioneering 18th century taxonomist. Neither a dictionary nor simply a collection of similar words, Roger had sorted and classified all human knowledge, Emblin notes emphatically. Although prior books of synonyms existed, none offered the depth or scope of the thesaurus that Roger published in 1853, for which he would become a household name, a synonym for all the source of all synonyms. Over the next 16 years, Roger oversaw more than 24 additional editions and printings, so many that the stereotype plates created for the third volume in 1855 eventually wore out. Genius is rooted in an incessant quest for knowledge and an imagination that transcends boundaries. Roger's early travels exposed him to foreign cultures and new terrain. Science gave him structure. After his death on September 12, 1869, at the age of 90, Roger's son John took up editorship of the Thesaurus. In an introduction to the 1879 edition, John reported that his father had been working on an expanded edition in the last years of his life, scribbling words and phrases in the margins of an earlier version. His mind never stopped. And now we'll move on to a short article titled There's a Word for That by Teddy Brokaw. Lexicographers compiled practical and whimsical guides to synonyms centuries before Roget. Isidore of Seville, Etymologiae Sive Origines, circa 600-625. Synonymy, the concept of distinct words signifying the same thing, was understood as far back as ancient Greece, but the Archbishop of Seville authored the earliest work modern readers might recognize as a thesaurus. Writing in Latin, Isidore sought to help readers distinguish between easily confused words. Drinking is nature, boozing is luxury. John of Garland, Synonymia, circa 1225-1250. This English grammarian's work was one of the first attempts to teach budding orators to punch up their speech by using different words to express the same idea. Organized alphabetically, like a modern thesaurus, it was written entirely in Latin verse and meant to be committed to memory. Garland encouraged orators to be attentive to context. A barking conus might be man's best friend, but a swimming conus would be a sea dog, a shark. Erasmus, Copia, 1512. The Dutch humanist Book of Latin Rhetoric went through nearly 100 print runs. It would influence many future writers, including Shakespeare. Erasmus delighted in showing how a sentence could be rephrased almost limitlessly. He demonstrated 150 ways to express, "Your letter pleased me mightily." For example, "Your epistle afforded me no small joy." Gabriel Gerard, Le Jutes de la langue française, ou les différentes significations des mots qui passent pour synonymes. 1718. The French abbot emphasized the distinctions between similar words in his Synonymary. A man is stupid because he cannot learn, but ignorant because he does not learn. His book was a runaway success, inspiring a wave of imitators and influenced Voltaire and Diderot. Hester Piozzi, British Synonymy, 1794. The English writer produced the first original English work of synonymy after seeing her Italian husband struggle with conversational English. Despite her lexicographical prowess, Piozzi limited her book to the realm of familiar talk. Her synonymy was reprinted several times, including a heavily censored French edition published as Napoleon came to power, and which was conspicuously missing its entry for tyranny. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.